So, Dan, rather than discussing your writing this week, we're going to talk about your eyewitness, experience yesterday, Saturday, at the, I guess, Boston Commons is where the Antifa versus two guys who called themselves white supremacists or Nazis or whatever the hell they were supposed to be. In other words, this massive counter rally against a minuscule rally.
Right. And, right. So leading up to this, the events in Charlottesville, as you have covered in much detail, got a lot of activity and response in both the media, activist groups here in Boston, because a group of so-called free speech advocates had already scheduled a visit to Boston in the Common to hold a rally. And this incited the left here in Boston, what calls themselves the left here in Boston, as well as the media, to respond in a manner similar to what happened in Charlottesville, where counter demonstrators clashed with right-wing or what's called the alt-right forces out there. And this rally was proposed from the free speech side to be at least a few hundred, if not some were saying 500 in the media. But in the aftermath of Charlottesville, this began to change. What ended up really happening was a lot of the free speech advocates began to get cold feet. They were not so open to speaking in front of what was estimated to be thousands of counter protesters, and that's indeed what happened. Yeah. Most of them left. NPR and other WBUR and other media out here were reporting that by the time about noon rolled around, maybe a little after, the free speech advocates, these right-wing forces, were actually sitting in a gazebo taking YouTube videos because they were no longer going to speak, and they were citing that the police were trying to escort them off. And this was all met by the left forces, or what calls themselves the left here, to a tune of about 30,000 people, according to media reports. When I got there, it seemed a little bit smaller than that. I had already known from my various connections here out in Boston that the demonstration was actually split in two. The more radical left groups were holding their own kind of standout called Stand for Solidarity near the State House here in Boston, while the Black Lives Matter groups, who tend to be on the more conservative side when it comes to things like demands and, you know, who gets to speak, they decided to hold a march from Roxbury all the way to the downtown area. And, you know, all in total, probably around 30,000 people. And when I got there, it was much smaller. The free speech advocates had dispersed. However, there was still quite a few thousand people demonstrating in the park, chanting things like no KKK, no fascist USA, things like that. And there was quite a few instances where provocateurs would basically incite, you know, the more anarchistic forces like Antifa to chase them around the park, and that would bring the police in. That happened probably a couple of times. Those are probably the instances where, you know, real discipline, strategy, and organization would have been helpful, because, you know, there was really no reason to get into any violent confrontations with anyone at such a demonstration.
Yeah, let me just get clear for a minute. So, you know, because people have all these names for themselves, and then the media has names for them, and you know, it's all very puzzling to an observer. You know that. You know, the media will call this one right and this one left. And, you know, they call the Democrats left, for example, and some Democrats far left, and, you know, which is, absurd unless you're narrow banding, like, you know, halfway between center and right, or right of that. So you mentioned free speech advocates, for example. I'm assuming that those are people that are the right or alt-right, as they're called in the media. These are the people that are saying, well, don't take down statues you know, just because the subject matter was racist, it's part of history, it's this or whatever. Those are who you're calling free speech advocates, and that the media would call the alt-right or the Nazis or whatever, and that the other group, the tens of thousands comprised of on Black Lives Matter protesters, quote unquote, and we know sort of, you know, after a couple of years of exposure in the media, the, you know, philosophical or ideological position taken there, and then also this Antifa, which, you know, I mean, the name is a contraction of anti-fascist, but, you know, anti-fascist sounds like there would be some ideological position being staked out. First of all, identifying fascism and then, you know, counterposing something to it. And that would be the organizing principle of Antifa. And we really haven't heard much of any of that. So, you know, I'm trying to parse what the report basically, because of the terminology, is so, you know, befuddling in this particular environment. So, all right, so you've got a small group of people who are being called the alt-right or white supremacists or Nazis, even though, as Trump tried to articulate, you may have those within this group, but you have others who don't identify that way, and who perhaps you might not identify that way either, you know, objectively, that are just there over, you know, some narrow specific issue, like, you know, my uncle was the sculptor, don't take that down, or we don't think any of these old statues should come down, but rather be used for tea, you know, whatever the reason for their protesting, they're not necessarily, this is what Trump was articulating, fascists or racists or whatever. So you're including everyone there as part of the free speech group, and then the others as either Antifa or Black Lives Matter. And do I have that right? Just so we'll talk about it. Okay.
Yeah, you do, definitely. Okay. I mean, all right. It's as you said, it's a very difficult period to be able to understand really what's going on, because the conversation, the rhetoric, the political debate around this question is so intense. And part of that is, you know, just from my experience being there, you know, you could probably easily say that 50% of those people that were there were, you know, aligned with the corporate Democrats and their agenda to equate fascism with Trump in order to stake out a position of legitimacy in the coming days as they struggle to oust Trump and, you know, re-implement a program or continue to implement their program in a way that is much easier than it is right now. And that's the danger of this moment. And it was very apparent at this demonstration because, you know, it's one thing to want to squash and fight and struggle against racist ideas, and that's a legitimate struggle. But it's a whole other thing to struggle against these racist ideas at the expense of a broader outlook in a broader struggle that really places the system of exploitation at the center. And I didn't see that. I mean, I got there late. I know that there are radical left groups who are trying to do that. But at the end of the day, what compelled this action in the first place doesn't really lend itself to that kind of struggle, because I think that when we think about forces like Antifa, and, you know, these forces are very hard to define. They're very hard to even talk to be honest. And, you know, it's different in every place. You have some Antifa forces like picking up U.S. weapons, going to Syria and fighting for the so-called Kurdish struggle out there, right? To supposedly fight ISIS. But we all know what's really going on in Syria whenever it comes to U.S. weaponry. So we have all of these various reports that really confuse the situation. And the left is very defensive about Antifa. You know, they say that they're protecting people. They say that they are, you know, the best we have right now. But in reality, it's a lot deeper than that. And we have to start talking about what's the broader significance of this moment. It isn't these, you know, tiki torch carrying college Republican, you know, so-called alt-right, you know, partyless forces at this time. They're puny. They're not at the doorsteps of power. Sure, they say things that a lot of people on the left will not like, but at the same time, we have to think about what's our program and what's going to win over the forces that they will win over if we continue to go down this dead end road of political, just political crisis that the whole left is in right now.
Yeah, I mean, you got a couple things here. First of all, I'm not concerned with a few hundred, even if they're all crazies, right wing protesters, because they're not pretending to speak for me, unlike, mm-hmm. The Antifa. I've been opposed to calling out, naming, and struggling with fascism my adult life. Mm-hmm. And you can understand why, of course, you don't have the DNC identifying on paper for people what fascism is, when what it is, you know, the acquisition of state power by corporate power, warlike foreign policy, militaristic, cultural ideology, et cetera, which is exactly what we have in the United States now. You can understand instead why they circulate, 14 markers of fascism that delete most of the things that I just mentioned that are actually the markers of fascism, because the DNC, like the RNC, or, 2 feet of the, clad in fascist boots that have been marching on the necks of most of the people of the world, at least since World War II, and really since, the 15th century. So you can understand why they don't, why they're not doing that. But these, if you're looking at, some sort of an ideological framework from which to criticize and attack and challenge and successfully negate fascism, you have to identify it clearly and make sure that, you empower yourself and our class to do that, definition, rather than to have it handed to you by, in the case that we're looking at right now, our mutual class enemy. Mm-hmm. The corporate media are not mm-hmm. the ones to tell us, "Those are fascists. Go get them."
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Goebbels would. He still drools in his coffin over what the American media are, so for them to say, "Go get that guy. He's a fascist." I would be just "Oh, really? Could you give me some evidence, or at least an argument?"
Yeah, exactly. I would love if this moment would lend itself to the ability to really understand fascism and to get into exactly what that term means and its significance in the actual political conditions that exist in the United States and the world. However, as you said, and as I completely agree, I mean, there is this real threat that exists that presupposes a fascist takeover here in the United States based on the corporate Democrats and their allies in the Republican Party's interest to basically fearmonger voters and the left and whoever will kind of take the bait into joining into what I think is ultimately an illegitimate struggle against one man, Donald Trump, who has basically, as we saw in recent events, or especially over the course of this 6 months to a year, has been in a complete and utter struggle to not be completely neutralized, which is seems to be closer by the day. And it's what Steve Bannon indicated after he resigned from his post. And I think what's tough is that we are in a moment where there are so many real and legitimate threats, the threat of nuclear war, the threat of impending economic collapse, a pressure cooker in the imperialist system, which is in grave crisis. And we have forces out there that we have to understand are really just using this notion of a white supremacist fascist takeover as a proxy to achieve greater ends that in and of themselves are fascist and white supremacist in character. And we have, and I think, as you said, we have to understand this moment as closer to fascism, as real identifiable fascism, as it emanates from the state and from actual levers of power, than just some independent force. When has this ever happened? Some independent force of individuals who come together and decide that it's now time, because Trump is in office, to retake the levers of state power. It's absolutely completely historical. It doesn't understand U.S., the particularity of the U.S. empire. And it really gets us into real deep trouble that, as exciting as thousands of people in the street are denouncing white supremacy, we know what thousands we know that this is a moment where there's all sorts of influential forces in the halls of corporate power that have the ability to take this where we hope it won't go, but where we're basically seeing it go, which is down the path of bourgeois and imperialist politics. That's where we're seeing it go.
You know, so. If you know, the question I would pose to Antifa that are there organized against white supremacy, which is a bigger marker of white supremacy, and more importantly, which of these is one of the legs upon which it stands and intends to stand as it intends to march forward, which of the following? Is it the statue of Robert E. Lee in some park in Virginia, or is it AFRICOM? And AFRICOM is the African command of the United States military that was installed in essentially a command and control position coordinate on 35 African countries' militaries. And this happened subsequent to its founding in October of 2008. And as a matter of fact, it really was implemented by taking out Libya and Gaddafi and began accumulating the relationships with these countries where they now essentially run the military. The U.S. runs the military of 35 African countries at this point in time. That was done by Obama. Is that on par as a marker and also enabler of white supremacy with a statue of somebody, whoever it is? And so if you're fighting white supremacy, what the hell are you doing with a statue?
Exactly. Or how about when the Obama administration signed that 2012 National Defense Authorization Act with the provision that it would grant the president the ability to indefinitely detain under military imprisonment, basically on a whim, on whoever the president deemed to be a terrorist. And that included also extrajudicially murdering anyone that he, U.S. citizen or not, that he deemed to be a terrorist threat. Is that not?
So, okay, well, we're stopping imperialism, for example, like some folks like to stop imperialism. Well, while we stop imperialism, do we look again at, let's say, AFRICOM and this statue? And while we're fighting fascism, do we look to the NDAA powers taken and also the whole legacy of, you know, we've got still got the Patriot Act, quote unquote, in effect? You know, I'm just stunned that there isn't a massive demonstration in Stuttgart shutting down AFRICOM, where it's based, or at various places in the United States, like in Washington, D.C., like, say, for example, outside Congress, demanding that they repeal the actual fascist legislation that we've been laboring under. It just, let's just take the last 16 years worth, since the 15 and a half, 16 years worth of the Patriot Act forward.
Yeah, it really reveals the depth of the political crisis in the United States, really, because when we look at what's going on right now, we can really see that there are forces in power, the ruling class. It's multiple political strands. You know, here in the United States, it's roughly two, and those two, the Republicans and the Democrats, are united on an agenda to maintain and expand the influence of the imperialist system, we could call a fascist system as a whole, and is doing so under such a difficult and crisis-ridden conditions that what we're seeing is a full-out assault on working people, a full-out assault on oppressed people all around the world. And, you know, I think Luciana Bone, she posted on her Facebook recently, you've been having her on, and she's wonderful, and she posted a quote by Stalin talking about how the colonies are a class struggle. And she said that the reason why the left isn't going anywhere is because they cannot seem to see that the struggle of oppressed people around the world are indeed a class struggle. The struggle for self-determination and national sovereignty is a class struggle. And that is what's missing from this moment. And it's missing primarily because what I think are the actual levers of fascist power in the United States, the various institutions of the state are operating in a way where the ideology of these so-called movements are really being defined by what the corporate media is saying, by what these organizations, these, you know, covert organizations, whatever we want to say, you know, the soft power organizations are really influencing the ideas of the band of activists that are organizing these things.
Well,
and
yeah,
that's a criticism that should be
examined.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, it might be interesting for us to ask, you know, you're an activist and you're in Boston. So, you know, be interesting to know what your email traffic and social media traffic looked like, you know, in terms of the organizing. Like, who was outreaching to you, you know, and what kind of outreach efforts did you see coming to you? You know, like I get from Move On, I get from, you know, all kinds of, you know, I that's how you monitor what's going on, is that, you know, as many as you can keep track of to try to do that. So what were some of the busiest organizers that were trying to get you to come to this rally that you saw, that you can think of, and what was the pitch?
So, you know, in Boston, the nonprofit industrial complex is very deeply embedded, so deeply embedded that it's actually kind of hard to see them. They're not very visible. They don't operate in a very outward manner. Going there, it was obvious to see that there were many people who were basically corporate Democrats angry at Trump. And when you see that, you know that the Move-Ons and whatever. I don't follow those websites or those organizations so well, so I didn't get anything from them. But they were obviously there. More so were the more independent activist groups that were doing mostly social media outreach. I know that some of the radical groups were, you know, doing more of their in-person outreach, and, you know, that's well and good. But for the most part, most people were there because of social media outreach. And there are two different groups of coalitions, two different sections of coalitions that were organizing for this, one for a march in Roxbury to Boston and one for just a demonstration. And the demonstration in the street that wasn't a march by the State House was Party for Socialism and Liberation, the Fight for 15 groups, various Answer Coalition, they were doing their thing. And then Black Lives Matter, both Boston and Cambridge, as well as some other smaller nonprofit groups, you know, immigrant rights groups. They were doing the march. The pitch was mostly that, you know, we're out here to stand against white supremacy. The PSL group, as well as their allies, had demands for local struggles, for people to get involved with. I actually think that's a relatively good use of time when you have thousands of people around. The Black Lives Matter group, however, were really only looking to a march in an open mic. They didn't want demands. They didn't want any kind of ideological discussion. Theirs was more of a pressure release, and they were kind of advertising it like that. So you have these kind of two strands of what to do with this development, but not much about, there was no kind of, you know, let's take this struggle and let's take it to another level. I think that right. that was largely missing. It was somewhat rhetorical on the side of the more far left groups, but in terms of the overall picture, it's pretty obvious that there's a deep conflict between the forces of the right that are kind of defined by Donald Trump and the more, quote unquote liberal factions of the ruling class and their supporters who are looking to use this to their advantage. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are there who were, you know, for the most part, Democrats. Not many people probably want to admit it because that's a tough thing to admit. But, you know, I heard a lot of conversations in the street about things like, oh, what flag are they burning? Oh, the Confederate flag? Not the American flag. That's good. That's good. Right. I can accept that. You know, like there was a lot of that going on. I walked around. I made sure to walk around. I made sure to, you know, talk to people. And that was kind of that was a lot of the conversation that was going on. So yeah. that's a deep problem.
Yeah, I think so too.
Deep problem we have to acknowledge. So that the conversation was mostly Black Lives Matter, which has turned the network organization has become very nonprofit-esque, and that hasn't really been talked about. But then again, their numbers and their influence has wildly kind of diminished from the struggle here in Boston. And then you had the more radical left groups who were, you know, trying to do their own thing and use their own strategy. But in terms of understanding this moment and trying to criticize and kind of come to a higher level of political discussion about this, not much of that going on.
And of course, with that means getting to a higher level of political activity is going to be a little bit off in the future. Dan, thank you very much for, you know, filling us in on what you saw and for kicking it around. And I'm hoping I will see you put pen to paper or finger to keyboard or whatever the phrase is now. One of your pieces and reduce some of this to writing that you saw. It'd be interesting to read and share. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Don.